materials relating to this oral argument, and the students will meet with Justice Prosser at noon. And now I'm going to show you and tell you who Justice Prosser is. Justice Prosser is the justice on the far right of the bench. That is my far right, your left. And seated next to Justice Prosser is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. And seated to my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. And I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. And to my left is Justice John Wilcox, and to his left, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far left, Justice Diane Sykes. And anyone who is interested in a summary of the case you're about to hear may go to that far desk where our deputy marshal is seated, and there will be available for you a summary of the issues that are involved in this case. So, with those introductory remarks stated, we're going to now turn to 98-2746CR, Safety Diagonal. We'll hear from James Prima, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Assistant Attorney General James Prima, representing Petitioner State of Wisconsin. This case is before the court on the state's petition to review an adverse decision of the Court of Appeals. In 1998, defendant Todd Dagnell pled no contest to first-degree intentional homicide while using a dangerous weapon. As part of a plea agreement, a companion charge of burglary while armed was dismissed. The ultimate question before this court is the following. Did law enforcement officers properly obtain statements from the defendant in accordance with his Sixth Amendment right to counsel? The trial court said yes, the Court of Appeals said no, and the state is asking this court to say yes. If the answer is yes, then defendant's statements would be admissible at a trial and there would be no basis for plea withdrawal. I believe there are two predicate legal issues that this court must decide before deciding resolving the ultimate question. Those two are the following. First, what is the standard for determining whether a defendant's reference to counsel to police is ambiguous under the Sixth Amendment? In particular, is this threshold standard of ambiguity the same as under the Fifth Amendment? Second, if an accused's reference to counsel is ambiguous under the Sixth Amendment, can the questioning officer proceed to ask about the charged crime, as the officer can do in the Fifth Amendment context, or must the officer first clarify the ambiguity? Once these legal questions are answered, they can be applied to the facts of this case, producing the following two questions. Did defendant personally and unambiguously invoke his right to counsel when the officers contacted him in Florida? And if his reference to counsel was ambiguous, did the officers properly respond? Before outlining the relevant facts, I'd just like to summarize the five propositions that the state would have this court decide or adopt. First, the same reasonableness standard enunciated by the United States Supreme Court in Davis versus United States for determining under the Fifth Amendment if a custodial suspect has unambiguously requested counsel should also apply under the Sixth Amendment when the defendant's first government contact after charging is with police. Second, in this case, defendant did not personally and unambiguously invoke the right to counsel to police. The attorney letter from Attorney Connors and the My Lawyer Told Me comment did not unambiguously express defendant's personal choice to proceed with counsel from that point forward. Third, for Sixth Amendment purposes, the state accepts the proposition that once a defendant has been formally charged, police must clarify an ambiguous reference to counsel. This is a departure from the Fifth Amendment.
Would you amplify on that? Immediately, without further questioning, they have to...
I'm sorry?
Are you saying immediately, without any further questioning, Once there's a statement, it appears to be ambiguous. The next question the officer has to be a question of clarification.
Right. In other words, they cannot continue questioning about the homicide. They must clarify whether the defendant is invoking counsel.
I'm sorry for interrupting you.
No, that's okay.
Three.
The fourth, then, is the application of the clarification principle to this case, and that is, in this case, the officer has properly clarified that the defendant was not invoking his right to counsel when the officers read him his Miranda rights, told him it was his decision how to proceed, and assured him they would honor his decision. And finally, the last part of the analysis I don't believe there's any dispute on, and that is, if you find that the defendant did not invoke his right to counsel, then the officers could, and did in this case, obtain a valid waiver of the right to counsel and the right to silence before eliciting from him the statements in question. Quick summary of the facts. Defendant was formally charged with first-degree intentional homicide by complaint filed October 14, 1997. That same day, a local Madison attorney, James Connors, submitted a written request to the Dane County Sheriff's Department that said three things, and I quote, "I represent Todd Dagnell, who has been arrested in Florida for your instructions." Second statement, quote, "It is my understanding that Mr. Dagnell is a suspect in a homicide in Dane County." And third, quote, "I do not want my client questioned by anyone concerning the homicide in which he is a suspect." This letter does not contain defendant's signature, nor does it state that defendant had retained or accepted attorney Connors as his attorney for defending against the homicide charge. Sheriff's Detective Kevin Hughes was aware of this letter before he went to Florida to retrieve the defendant, bring him back to Dane County the next day. He was accompanied by a DeForest police officer. The first thing that the detective said to defendant in Florida was that he was there, quote, regarding the homicide. The trial court expressly found that defendant's response was, quote, "My lawyer told me that I shouldn't talk to you guys," unquote. Detective Hughes then told defendant, and I quote his testimony, "We have been conducting interviews and talking to other people regarding the homicide, and that it was his decision as to whether or not he wanted to talk to us, and we would like to read him his rights, and after you heard his rights, he could make a decision as to whether or not he wished to provide a statement," unquote. The detective told defendant they would honor his decision. Detective Hughes then read defendant his Miranda rights. Defendant acknowledged he understood them, including the right to have counsel present. Defendant said he would talk to the officers until he felt like he was incriminating himself. Until that point, the detective had not asked him any questions about the homicide. The defendant received no promises or threats, did not appear intoxicated or unresponsive, and never asked for counsel or to stop the questioning. And the final fact, the next day at the airport when they were coming back to Wisconsin, defendant agreed to talk more about the homicide the next day, and he again acknowledged and waived his Miranda rights.
Okay, having stated those facts, let me change the facts just a little bit, just to play this out a bit. What if instead of a letter from the attorney to the police, the attorney was standing in the Florida jail when the police arrived? And the attorney says to the police, "This is my client." The exact same thing that he said in the letter, except he says it orally. And the client standing there, the defendant standing there, says exactly what he said here. Does that change the law here? Does that change the result that you were asking for?
I think it may. I think there, if there's an affirmative assertion that I'm representing him and he's standing right here and he doesn't dispute that, I think you still need to hear from him.
Well, but he says, "My lawyer."
Well, if he's saying the same thing, if he says, "My lawyer," and it's clear that he's referring to this gentleman standing right next to him who just said, "I represent him," I think then you could say that's not an ambiguous invocation that he's saying it. He has.
Why is proximity, why is the postal a determining factor here?
Well, I think with the letter, you don't have anything either in the letter, in the content or the form of the letter that says the defendant is agreeing to do this.
You've got that, but then it all comes together when essentially the defendant affirms the letter by saying, "My lawyer."
Sure, and the state's disagreement with that is that the term "my lawyer" could mean, is not crystal clear that he's accepting a particular lawyer to represent him in this homicide. In other words...
Wait, let me just...
Sure.
You're saying that the trial court could not make the inference that that Connor was the lawyer?
No, I think they could. I think that is one reason.
They did not. Is that your point?
Or was
the trial court silent?
I'm sorry?
Or was the trial court... I think this is what you're gonna say. Was the trial court silent on that issue?
No, Judge Fiedler said that he found, I think, expressly that he had a lawyer. But there's a difference here that I'm trying to stress, and that it's a subtle difference, but I think it's the key difference in this case and an important difference, and that is, under these facts, when he says, my lawyer, it's almost as if he's not talking in the first person at all. He's saying, my lawyer told me this. And it's, in that context, the reasonable officer could say, well, okay, that means he must have a lawyer, he's accepted a lawyer, or it could mean, my lawyer could mean, well, I'm referring to the lawyer who's been hired to me and has talked to me. But there's kind of a pregnant but at the end of that sentence. In other words, what do you, defendant, want to do?
Well, then it doesn't make any difference in practice. It doesn't matter whether the lawyer is standing there. The lawyer doesn't, it doesn't matter if we accept that Connor is the lawyer. You're saying that what is ambiguous, if I don't want to put words in your mouth. But what I hear you saying is his statement is ambiguous as to whether he is asking for his lawyer.
Right. And I just going back to your hypothetical,
point?
I think, yeah, you're right. If everything is exactly the same and he's standing there and there's really not that coagulation, if you will, that this is my lawyer, there's a personal reference to him, it would not be an unequivocal invocation. I guess I was suggesting that if they're there and they're kind of acknowledging one another and that kind of thing, in that context, it makes it a little easier to interpret these words if that lawyer is standing there. With this letter, the police officer doesn't have to accept that. They don't know for sure. I mean, this is an attorney making a unilateral assertion that he's representing this individual.
Well, what difference does it make? Suppose you don't have the letter at all. No letter. And the man says, the defendant says to the police, my lawyer, he could be lying, doesn't matter.
Sure.
My lawyer told me not to talk to you guys. Your position is that is what?
Ambiguous.
Ambiguous.
For essentially, but not quite, the same reason that it was found to be ambiguous in the Fifth Amendment context. And that is that doesn't say what the defendant wants to do personally. It's saying, this person, who he's called my lawyer, says I shouldn't talk to you. But because of the way that's phrased, a reasonable police officer could construe that to mean, well, this defendant, I'm not sure what this defendant wants to do. I haven't heard personally from him.
And suppose the police officer knows that Connor is the lawyer, knows that the attorney has told him that, and the introduction is, my lawyer, Connor, told me not to talk to you guys. What's the state's position? I mean, I think that's the...
Same thing. He's now identified. I mean... Excuse me. I'm sorry.
No, that's the issue that I think we're driving at.
Absolutely. And I think in that situation, you still have the ambiguity in this sense, that now he's identified a particular lawyer, but it's still the same ambiguity that's present there.
So the state's position is the same?
Yes.
That you don't have an unambiguous invocation of the right to counsel.
Correct.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Does the record indicate how Mr. Connors became the attorney?
As far as I know, it does not. I'm sorry. Let me qualify that. After, or the first initial appearance, when they're back to Wisconsin, make an initial appearance in court, Attorney Connors makes some indication that he has talked about the defendant's father, I think, regarding fees. So there is, I mean, there's an inference, but it's not, you can't tell that perhaps it was the parent, father, who had, in fact, hired Attorney Connors for the defendant. And, in fact, Attorney Connors does, in fact, represent the defendant at these proceedings that occur.
Does the record indicate whether Mr. Connors actually spoke with the defendant in Florida?
Only by inference. In the content of the letter, it says, I believe, I'm sorry, trying to remember exactly what his comment was in the letter. No, I guess it doesn't in the letter itself. I guess it would be only in the defendant's comment, "My lawyer told me not to talk to you," that would suggest that, in fact, he has talked to an attorney, and coupled with that attorney letter from Attorney Connors would suggest that, in fact, he had talked to Attorney Connors. I think that's a reasonable inference to draw from that.
What are the magic... Are you going to suggest?
If I could ask one other. The word discriminate comes into... Who said the word discriminate?
That was the defendant's response after the officer told him that it was his decision to, and he read him his Miranda rights, it's your decision whether you want to talk to us, whether you want counsel. And then the defendant says, well, I will talk to you until I feel that I'm... It was the officer's testimony of what the defendant said, and the officer said that the defendant told us he would talk to us until he felt he would discriminate against himself, and the inference there, I think, reasonable, is that he meant incriminate himself. This is the officer testifying at the hearing as to what defendant told him.
What inference should we draw about the defendant's intelligence from his use of that word?
If that was the defendant's word, just that perhaps he didn't either, he misspoke or he wasn't familiar enough with the meaning of incriminate versus discriminate. I think there certainly is an issue about what about a suspect or a defendant who isn't articulate, who can't speak, like I'm having trouble speaking now. But the Supreme Court has said that we worry about that, we cover that, because we then, with the Miranda rights and the state's burden of requiring a knowing and voluntary waiver of those rights, that's what ensures that even the defendant who can't articulate as clearly and succinctly as the next person, that's what protects that invocation of counsel, is by that those Miranda rights and the requirement that it be a knowing and voluntary waiver.
Is there a requirement of a personal invocation of the right to a lawyer at a post-charging lineup?
At a corporal lineup? I believe that's right. I believe it's considered a critical stage.
And must there be a personal invocation by the defendant of the right to a lawyer in that context, or is that automatically suppressed unless there's an attenuation analysis done later?
It's a good question. I hadn't thought about the answer. I think, again, we're talking about if there's been no previous invocation, if there's been no court appearance, if nothing else has happened to that point, at some point the defendant has to say, this is my lawyer, I want a lawyer from this point forward. The Sixth Amendment applies from that point forward.
Well, what's the status of the law, though? A post-charging lineup cannot be conducted without the presence of a lawyer, right?
And if he has the right to counsel. He has the right to an attorney there.
And if it is, you don't get the ID admitted off of that lineup unless the ID is sufficiently attenuated from that lineup, right?
Unless there's been a waiver of counsel, is that, yeah, I mean...
In the absence of an affirmative waiver. But in that context, the personal invocation is not required.
I still think it is. I think it doesn't arise because normally it might be a post-charging. Well, I guess it wouldn't have to be. It could be a pre-charging situation. But I still think that...
The reason I'm asking is to try to delineate what the difference is between these two post-charging contacts with the police, and is there any meaningful difference?
Well, I think it depends on the stage in the process. The Sixth Amendment right attaches once there's charging, and I guess the unspoken, I don't find a clear explication of this in the cases, is that, well, if the state feels it has enough to charge the defendant, then the need for the state's investigation to actually question the defendant isn't as great as before, where they're in the pre-charging.
Mr. Freiman, isn't it that his appearance does not raise this testimonial issue? If you start to question him at the lineup, then you may very well have this problem.
Sure, it's a sure.
So usually in a lineup, you're lined up.
Right.
But fingerprints, you don't need counsel.
You don't need counsel,
right. You
can't
vote counsel because you don't have any rights to this, your appearance.
Sure. I'm trying to explain, I guess, is the difference between the Fifth and Sixth Amendment. Sixth Amendment right attaches after charging. Defendant's now the adversary. So there's some greater protection in the sense that from that point forward, at any critical stage, once he's invoked, and that's the critical part, he's got to have invoked it at some point to state authorities, whether it's at a court proceeding, whether it's to the police, at the time of the lineup, whatever it might be. Once he's invoked, then that right takes effect. It's in existence, but it hasn't taken effect until he personally invokes it.
Now, for Sixth Amendment purposes, is it the law that once the defendant has invoked his right to counsel, all questioning must cease?
Once he's invoked his right, it's just like the Fifth Amendment. That's
okay.
Correct.
Now, I'm troubled by this. What constitutes an invocation of the right to attorney? Obviously, if he says, I want an attorney, that's an invocation. What
sure.
If he says, I have an attorney?
It would imply that he has accepted an attorney. If he told the police, I have an attorney...
Isn't that one step after invoking? I mean, I want an attorney has to be preliminary to, I have an attorney.
Sure.
Okay, so when he says, I have an attorney, then hasn't he already invoked his right to counsel?
He has to, if he's saying that to the police, I have an attorney, this is my attorney, yes, then he's invoked.
So he's invoked. So all question must cease.
That's
now,
right. I'm sorry.
So now I bring it into this case. When he says, my attorney, isn't that the same thing as saying, I have an attorney?
I don't think so. And I guess that's the crux. That's the crux of this case. And the reason being is that the way this is phrased, a reasonable police officer could say, well, wait a minute, what is the defendant wanting to do here? He could be saying, my attorney, meaning the same thing as, I know an attorney has been hired for me, and this is the advice, and he says not to talk. But because of the way he phrases this, a reasonable officer could say, well, what do you want to do? I mean, this doesn't tell me that you want to proceed with an attorney.
You look at everything that he said, that the defendant has said, and clearly he's not saying my attorney who's representing me in a real estate deal. He's referring to the attorney who's representing him for the charges that are in front of him.
Yes.
And that has to come after. He wouldn't say, I want an attorney if he's already got one. And he's saying, I got one.
Sure.
I've got one not for a real estate deal, but I got one for this murder charge.
I guess all I can do is repeat what I said, and that is that I think it, given the way this is phrased, it's almost like this isn't the end of what he wants to say. He's saying, this third person, albeit he's calling him my lawyer, could mean that he knows his dad has hired him this attorney, and this attorney has said, don't talk to police. Now the police are there to talk to him, and they say, we're here regarding the homicide, and he says, my lawyer told me not to talk to you guys. That isn't an expression of what he wants to do, and I think it leaves open the question, not only does he want to talk, but does he want to proceed with counsel at that point? The my lawyer is ambiguous enough that it could mean, all I'm doing is saying I'm recognizing that an attorney has been hired. I'm not saying that I'm accepting that attorney.
Okay, so now let me take you back, and I'm sorry to occupy so much time on the court. You said that the third thing you want to accomplish is that for Sixth Amendment purposes, the police must clarify an ambiguous invocation of the right to counsel. Now, I take it that you are referring that the time sequence is when they confront the defendant. Why shouldn't we put that back to the time when the lawyer says, this is my client and I don't want you to talk to him?
Because there's nothing, again...
Why can't the police clarify the representation before they do anything?
Sure, they can, but I don't think they're required to because it's only the attorney's unilateral assertion. There's nothing in there that says...
Well, why doesn't that trigger the
requirement of clarification?
Yeah.
Because it isn't anything personal from the defendant expressing it. It's just an attorney's assertion in a letter. There's nothing that says, I, defendant, want to proceed with counsel.
Counsel, what do you do with what I think may be the situation here? You're saying adopt the Davis standard for Fifth Amendment, and I understand that to be such that a reasonable police officer would have thought that counsel was being invoked from the totality of the circumstances.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, in some of your discussion, you said, well, he could have done this and he could have done that. The reasonable police officer could have understood this to be, and the reasonable police officer could have understood it to be something else. And I'm saying you're right.
the reasonable police officer could have understood this statement, together with the letter, to mean, my lawyer doesn't want me to talk to you, but let me tell you what I'm going to do, what I want to do. A reasonable police officer could do that. A reasonable police officer could also find invocation of a lawyer. Here's a letter, and my lawyer, much like what Justice Babich is pressing you on. So what I think you have here is a reasonable police officer could, and a reasonable police officer could not. Who has the burden?
I think it's an interesting question because I think the ultimate thing is a legal question. And I say that in this sense. If there are two competing inferences, both of which are reasonable, as I understand your scenario, yeah, we're talking about, then it's by definition ambiguous. And if the state the state has the burden, at least, I mean, the ultimate burden here is on the state to get this in. If the state can show that these are two reasonable inferences, then it has shown ambiguity.
And then you get to your number five, which is your proposed rule. When I say number five, that's the way I wrote it down. That is, or maybe it's number four, that the state has to immediately clarify any ambiguity. Whatever number it is.
Yeah.
So let's say, so as I'm pushing you, let's say I find it reasonable, and I listen to your argument, and you said a reasonable lawyer, a reasonable officer could do this, and a reasonable officer could, I'm advancing, find it the other way. So you've got an ambiguity, there's an obligation to immediately clarify, there was no immediate clarification, you're out.
You're saying there was none in this case?
Do you think there was an immediate
I think there was. I would respectfully disagree.
Well,
I would say
that. Let me ask.
Sure.
Let me ask. After, what does the record show? That after the statement was made that my lawyer would not want me to talk to you, whatever it was, what was the next thing said?
I believe it was said that we have talked to other people.
Yeah. Is that part of the, is that a part of the specific clarification?
I don't think they necessarily had to do that, right? But I don't think it's harmful in any way. And,
okay.
and the reason
let
I
me,
no, go ahead.
I would answer my question. Is that part of clarification, the specific kind of clarification that you're advancing as part of the test?
I don't think it's part of the clarification of the right to counsel, right?
And your test is that it has to be immediately after the ambiguous statement.
I mean, not the very next breath. I would say in that same context of a response from the police. I think what was said here was all in the same breath. He's saying, we've talked to other people, we'd like to hear your side of the story. Presumably the defendant has understood by being arrested, and he may know he's been charged, that, you know, they've got information on him.
So you're advocating that if the statement is ambiguous, the officer, before immediate clarification, can say, well, let me tell you what some others have told us, and we want to hear what you want to say, and then after they hear what he wants to say, then the officer can immediately ask for clarification regarding invocation.
I think in some cases an officer can go too far in trying to influence a defendant's decision to talk. I don't think that happened here. My position is that when you take all this in context, the next breath was, you know, it's your decision, let me read you your Miranda rights, you know, you can tell us what you want to do.
Oh, right. Isn't that your position, basically, that the Miranda, an adequate Mirandization of the suspect after the ambiguous statement clears everything up and constitutes the clarification.
It's an adequate basis for clarification. This court said in Wachowiak as much.
How do you justify that answer under our court's decision in Wachowiak?
That's just what I was...
Our decision in Wachowiak, that the question there was, do you think I need an attorney?
Hmm?
The majority in the court said that was equivocal. So now they say, we hold that an equivocal question such as the one before us is insufficient to invoke the right, so it was not a per se invocation. And so mere mention of a counsel is not per se, it doesn't trigger Sixth Amendment. Then they go on to say, however, that what you have to do here is find out what's happening. And that in Wachowiak, and I'm reading from page 489, Well, COIAC was simply read her rights, told that she had to make her own decision about whether or not she wants an attorney, and given the opportunity to sign the waiver portion. But then the court sent this back and said, if I read it right, that they need more.
That's correct.
And
I would say they didn't need to send it back. That what was done, I guess they sent it back because they wanted to see the totality of the circumstances.
Yeah, but the same case we've got here. He makes an equivocal statement. Perhaps it's even closer to an invocation than in Walpoliak. Well, Koyak, the guy says, do I need a lawyer? He doesn't say, I have a lawyer. He doesn't say what my lawyer told me. And the court said, and then in Walpoliak, I didn't go back to the record in Walpoliak, but according to this, police officers did exactly what they did here.
Sure.
They said, it's your decision, buddy, and here are your Miranda rights. And the court then sends it back.
Right. And I would disagree that they needed to, unless for some reason that I'm not familiar enough with the facts to know if there was something more underlying this that would have been warranted such additional fact-finding. But our position would be that what was done in Walpoliak to that point would not have necessitated further remand.
No.
For
what?
For
a remand. Additional remand for fact-finding.
You see, now, it could be argued with COIAC, they only sent it back to do voluntary, knowing, and intelligent, and that the trial judge here did that. But I think that and I'm reading from page 490, it seems to me that that they did more. Therefore, remand to prefer the fact-finding. On remand, the circuit court must determine, consistent with the approach we adopt, whether the facts leading up to the inquiry and the context were made would render the statement an unequivocal request for counsel. So they did more than that. I mean, I read Koyak carefully because it just seemed to me it was right on point.
And again, I would say that I would disagree to that last step that Morris said, sir.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Simon. Mr. Lebarski.
Excuse me. My name is John Lebarski. I am an assistant state public defender, and I represent Todd Dagnall, who is the defendant appellant in this matter. I don't believe the resolution of the issue presented here requires a new constitutional rule. I don't believe it's necessary to fashion a new rule to address the defendant's assertion of his Sixth Amendment right to counsel out of Fifth Amendment case law designed to protect the suspect's right not to incriminate himself. Instead, I believe decisions of the United States Supreme Court, beginning with Gideon versus Wainwright, and Messiah versus the United States, through Michigan versus Jackson and Patterson versus Illinois, all provide this court with ample direction for a resolution of the issue presented. The principal decision which determines the outcome of this case, I believe, is Michigan versus Jackson. In Jackson, the court held that once a defendant's Sixth Amendment right to counsel has attached and been asserted, the police may not initiate interrogation concerning the charged crime in the absence of counsel. Jackson makes no mention of a personal invocation, nor does the case of Patterson versus Illinois, which follows. In Patterson versus Illinois, the defendant claimed that his Sixth Amendment right to counsel essentially grew out of the charging decision. In other words, that once he was charged, his right to counsel under the Sixth Amendment was automatic. In Patterson, the Supreme Court said that was not so, but that it was necessary for the defendant to invoke his right. Again, the Patterson court made no mention of the fact that any invocation need be personal. There's no question, I believe, in this case that the right to counsel attached with the filing of the criminal complaint. As the court is well aware, the issue for this court is whether the defendant asserted that right. I'd ask the court to bear in mind as well the admonition in Jackson that we ought to consider the right to counsel in a broad rather than a narrow interpretation. And it's my position in this case that by accepting the services of counsel, Mr. Dagnall indeed asserted his right to counsel. The letter that he wrote together with his statement clearly indicated his assertion of that right.
He didn't write the letter. The lawyer wrote the letter.
No, he didn't write the letter. The lawyer wrote the letter.
The lawyer wrote the letter.
It's my belief, Justice Babich, that you can infer from that letter, my client portion of that letter, that there's an acceptance of the relationship.
We're not dealing with two letters.
No. He didn't write a letter, nor did he co-sign that letter. The principal factual events of this case, I think individually and collectively, show that the defendant asserted his right to counsel. The letter that the defendant's counsel wrote, together with the inferences that I think you can readily draw from that letter, demonstrate that the defendant knowingly engaged the services of counsel, and thus, under Jackson, asserted his right to counsel. If the letter creates any ambiguity, it's my belief that the defendant's statement upon being confronted by the police certainly resolves that ambiguity. The state's position, as I understand it in this case, is that there is no reason not to apply Fifth Amendment principles to the defendant's Sixth Amendment claim. I think the state suggests that if you do that, and further if you consider individually the facts of this case, the letter and the defendant's statement, then you have to conclude that the defendant did not effectively assert his right to counsel. Essentially, the state argues that the lawyer letter wasn't good enough, nor were the defendant's own words good enough. Finally, I think the state argues that if some accommodation is necessary because this is a Sixth Amendment case, all that's required is that the police clarify the defendant's desire for counsel, and that's simply what happened here.
Now, under Davis, do they have to clarify?
In Davis, no. I think in Davis, the suggestion is that if the defendant does not meet a threshold of clarity, then the police are under no obligation to clarify the suspect's statement. And I think that in suggesting here that there is such an obligation, the state is suggesting essentially a new constitutional rule, which I don't think is necessary. There are good reasons, I think, not to apply Fifth Amendment analysis to the defendant's Sixth Amendment case. I think it's fair to say that if the defendant in this case was simply a suspect and not a charged defendant, there's a good chance that this case would not have gotten as far as it has. That distinction, I think, between a suspect and a defendant is a critical one for a resolution of this case. As Gideon said, and as this court said in State versus Plessy, there is no more fundamental right than the Sixth Amendment right to counsel.
Tell me what rule you want this court to apply. What's the general standard? Anytime the defendant, the charged defendant, says the word attorney, stop. Is that the rule you asked for?
I'm glad you asked that. I would propose the following rule of this case, that once a person charged with a crime accepts the services of counsel, the police may not initiate interrogation with the defendant. Jackson
once
says that
once charged with crime and defendant what?
Once a person charged with a crime accepts the services of counsel, the police may not initiate interrogation with the defendant in the absence of counsel.
Well, that necessarily requires knowledge of the police, then. What if the police don't know and the defendant never tells?
Then it's a much more problematic situation.
But I mean,
that's not the issue.
Doesn't your rule way too broad?
What to now?
Or to now? It seems to me that you would say once the defendant accepts the services of counsel and the police are aware of that.
That's correct. I would amend that to suggest that the police in some fashion need to be aware of that. And that's essentially what the court in Jackson said. Once a defendant asserts the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, if the police thereafter initiate interrogation, any waiver of the defendant...
The defendant doesn't have to have any assertion under your rule.
Yes, he does. I think in this case, by accepting the services of counsel, he in effect asserts his right to counsel.
Okay. That's the point. That your point is that the invocation is through accepting the service of counsel. So here, Connors writes the letter and says that I represent this defendant, don't talk to him. Is that good enough under your rule?
It's a closer case, but I think it is. I think that the inferences you can draw from that letter make it clear that the defendant accepted the services of counsel and thereby asserted his right to counsel.
What if there's a question under your rule? What if the police get the letter from Connor and the letter says, he's my counsel, he's my client. So now the police have become aware of that. At least maybe he does, but they're not quite sure. Maybe this is a lawyer who's out ambulance chasing him. Maybe he hasn't really spoken with this defendant. Does a duty on behalf of the police arise at that point to clarify?
Well, my position is that the letter itself is sufficient. If the letter creates any ambiguity, that ambiguity is resolved upon the first contact with the defendant in this case.
So you would not say that the police have to resolve the ambiguity before first contact? They can wait until first contact and then resolve?
I think so.
And your rule of protect the cases that says that you're 17 and your mother and father hire lawyers from you and you haven't known about that, that the police can question you anyway. I mean, there are those cases.
For a charged defendant or for a charged juvenile, if the parents of the juvenile hire a lawyer...
That may have been a Fifth Amendment case. Go ahead.
Yeah, it was a... there are a number of Fifth Amendment cases in this context having to do with a public defender attempting to intervene with a suspect and a parent.
You'd let all those go because you would limit this to a Sixth Amendment.
Correct.
Okay.
But those fact situations still come to my mind. What about a public defender who is representing some person on a disorderly conduct? All of a sudden, he finds out that client's a suspect in a homicide. So he hasn't talked with his client in several months. Case has been pending and adjourned on the disorderly conduct. But he gets a letter off. Please be advised. I'm his attorney, and I don't want you talking to him on this homicide. The guy doesn't even know about it.
I think that's the Kerber case, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. And the person is a suspect at that point in a homicide, so he's not a charged defendant, and therefore...
My hypothetical is have him charged, then. My point is that a public defender writing letters of representation without the defendant being aware of it. On a charged defense. How does your rule play with that?
Well, I think that in some fashion the individual defendant has to assert the right.
So the letter in and of itself isn't good enough.
Well, but I think that the inferences you can draw from this letter are enough. Now, I'm willing to concede that the letter may suggest some ambiguity, but...
Well, I've got a problem then. Let's say the letter says exactly what this letter says, but it's sent by a public defender who's never been in contact with the defendant in this regarding this charged offense. But the letter says the same thing. Is it good enough or is it not good enough?
Well, clearly it's a closer case. Fortunately, those aren't the facts of this case.
Why don't you just take the position that... that is up to the police. If there's this kind of ambiguity, to just check it. But all you have to do is ask the defendant, is Connors your lawyer for this charge? Not any other charge, not any other matter. And if the answer is yes, that ends it. Or they can call Connors. Say, have to talk to him. But I think that's just the easiest thing. Then you don't have to worry about all these ambiguous letters. I mean, they're down there in Florida. Not going to take any time to say, Connor's your lawyer.
Sure, the police certainly could do that.
And your position is, if that's it, if Connor's is the lawyer, then and Connor's is written, don't talk to my client, the cops can't talk to him. Is that your position?
If the defendant acknowledges that Connors is his lawyer,
right.
Certainly.
But then, why can't he change his mind? Connors now changes his mind. The defendant talked to Connors. Connors told him to be quiet. Defendant accepted Connors' representation. Now Connors is in Florida and he sees police and he thinks, I don't care, I want to talk anyway. They can do that. I mean, there are cases that indicate you can change your mind. I mean, it's the right is the defendant's, right?
Correct. He can change his mind, but the problem is with the police initiating the interrogation. There's no problem with Dagnall going to the police the following day saying, look, I've changed my mind. I don't want Connors and I want to talk to you.
Who talks to whom? Okay.
I'm sorry.
It depends on who initiates.
Correct. I mean, the rule of Jackson has to do with the police initiating interrogation. And I don't think there's a dispute in this case that interrogation was initiated by the police.
No, but the rule that you are...
Justice Wilcox,
no,
I'm sorry.
The rule that you're discussing and we're playing around the bench here, as I understand it, is it takes some knowledge. It takes some invocation, knowledge on the part of the defendant that there is, I have an attorney.
Yes.
And that's what you're talking about, that if you just send a letter, some public defender or private counsel just sends a letter, don't talk to this person, then I think that clearly that is not the case here, and you're not suggesting, you're suggesting that the invocation comes, I'm talking about your constitutional rights, when you have knowledge that there is a lawyer. You've invoked that. You know about the lawyer. And that's what took place here.
Correct. And I think when Dagnall said, my lawyer said I shouldn't talk to you guys, that was in effect Dagnall's acknowledgement of counsel.
Yes. So if the rule is that the defendant, if the police, one of the proposed rules, if the police have a duty to clarify an ambiguity by simply asking the defendant, which sounds like a very sound rule, is Mr. Connors your lawyer? And if he answers yes, the police have to just stop any conversation. They certainly can't say, well, we sure would like to hear your side of the story, but I guess we can't.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. I think once the right...
That Connors' lawyer didn't say anything about don't question him. Connors just said, I represent Dagnall. Please be advised, I represent Dagnall, period.
The same rule would apply.
Can't talk to him.
Correct.
Once
they've established that, in fact, the defendant knows he's got a lawyer, and that fact was found in this case by the trial court. There was a finding of fact by the trial court that the defendant was aware he had a lawyer.
Can't question. It doesn't matter that the officers know that the lawyer doesn't want him questioned.
Correct.
What's the finding of fact you're relying on from the trial court?
The trial court found in this case that the defendant was aware that he had a lawyer.
The defendant was aware.
Correct.
Did they make any finding with respect to what the police were aware of?
The court found that the police were aware of Connor's letter.
Okay.
And the court further found, as I indicated, that Dagnall was aware that he had a lawyer.
But did the trial court make any finding with respect to whether or not the police knew that Connor was representing Dagnall in this charge?
The court made the finding that the police knew of this letter and of this assertion by Connors. The state's argument is that that letter created some ambiguity and the police weren't really sure, I think is essentially what the state is arguing.
Mr. Lebowski, didn't Judge Fiedler find that the whole situation was ambiguous in terms of whether or not there was the invocation of the right to counsel and therefore the police had the right to clarify the situation?
That was what Judge Fiedler found, correct.
What kind of deference, if any, are we required to give to his findings?
I believe his findings amount to essentially findings of constitutional fact, which this court would review de novo.
How
How do you draw the line between historical fact and constitutional fact? I've always had trouble drawing the line.
Me too. It's kind of like, I guess I would try to explain it as the difference between kind of a contingent fact and an ultimate fact. And maybe I'm not being articulate in that regard, but the constitutional fact would be the ultimate conclusion that the statement was ambiguous or the statement was unequivocal. The predicate fact might be the statement itself. And a good example is in this particular case, the trial court found that Dagnoff's statement was made, my lawyer said I shouldn't talk to you. That finding of fact is entitled to deference. The conclusion that that was an ambiguous statement, I think, is a constitutional fact, which this court would review de novo. I might not be right on that, but that's my take.
You're not relying on that, whether it's equivocal or ambiguous or unambiguous. You want a flat rule. Doesn't matter what he said.
Correct. I think this case is resolved by Jackson and Patterson that require the right to attach and to be asserted. And then it becomes a question of fact. You look at the facts together with the inferences you can draw, the facts in this case being the letter and the statements. Does that amount to an assertion? And if you find that it amounts to assertion, then the case is controlled by Jackson. If you find that it doesn't amount to an assertion, then it's a different story.
Well, but you have an automatic assertion, if I hear your rule right, as soon as this man has a lawyer. Right? So all you have to do here is have finding the fact that the police knew he had a lawyer, which is not in dispute, as I understand it, and that Dagnall knew he had a lawyer.
And that he asserted it.
But why does he have to assert it at all? If the police know he has a lawyer and then they know Dagnall hired this guy, does Dagnall have to say a word? Can they question him anyway?
No, they can't. They can't question him, certainly.
But if I can tag along on this one. I think, just to make sure we understand your position, let's assume there was no letter from the lawyer, but we have the statement from Mr. Dagnall, as soon as he sees the police, my lawyer says I shouldn't answer. That would be enough.
In my opinion, yes. You know, it strikes me, as I stand before you here today, I have no piece of paper co-signed by Mr. Dagnall. I have nothing in the file that says I was appointed to represent Mr. Dagnall. I am here as his lawyer, yet it's not something that comes into question.
I think part of the problem here is that the rule that you're proposing, which is that once a person charged with a crime accepts the services of counsel, there cannot be any police initiated questioning, turns upon a communication between attorney and client as opposed to a communication between suspect and the police, which is what we're talking about here, right? And that's part of the problem with the proposed rule, is that you're proposing that suspect retains counsel, no more questioning, rather than suspect tells police, I'm talking to you only with my counsel here, end of questioning.
I guess I'm a little confused as to the question. The rule is that once a charged defendant accepts the services of counsel knowingly.
But without any communication of that fact to the police by the defendant himself, without that personal invocation.
Well, the police have to be aware of the fact that the defendant has counsel.
In any independent awareness, apart from an actual statement from the mouth of the defendant, I have a lawyer, I'm not talking to you without him here. I mean, that's how your rule would operate. The defendant doesn't have to do anything when the police actually have that confrontation with him. If the retention of the lawyer is already done, the cops know about it from any source whatsoever, they can't do anything to question the defendant or to find out if he actually wants to deal with them through his attorney or not.
If the police know that the defendant has a lawyer, And the defendant has asserted that right to counsel, then yes, I think the police are precluded from that.
Where
point.
Is the assertion?
Where's the assertion? Right, that's what I'm trying to get.
Where's the assertion?
Right.
The assertion in this case is my lawyer said it.
Okay, so the assertion does have to come from the mouth of the defendant at the time of the police, the first police contact with him in order to be effective.
Well, I think you can infer the assertion from the letter as well. I'm hesitant to put myself in a situation where I'm saying the letter alone isn't good enough, nor is the statement alone good enough. I think that the letter alone is a close case. The statement alone is, in my opinion, a sufficient assertion by the defendant. Put together, read in conjunction, the totality of the circumstances in this case, in my mind, clearly demonstrate the defendant's assertion.
So if
I don't know if that helps.
You got a letter from Connors, and the defendant also wrote a letter to the court, which is the police know about, saying, Connors is my lawyer. Can the police say, question him at all? There he hasn't asserted anything other than by letter saying, Connors is my lawyer. Is that good enough?
Yeah, you're asking me, is the letter alone good enough? That's a closer case, and I'm not sure of the answer. I may guess that begs the question,
yeah,
but
a letter from the defendant, is it good enough saying Connors is my lawyer?
A letter from the defendant would be
good enough.
Good enough.
So if that's a letter, or if somehow it's known from the file that Connors actually is the defendant's counsel, the police cannot question him without counsel present.
Correct.
So from now on, if that rule is accepted, then what the public defender or defense counsel should do is immediately get a letter, put it in file, send it to the cops, and then they can't question.
I don't understand you saying that.
No, I thought you switched gears on me here. You were talking in one instance about a letter from the lawyer and then a letter from the defendant.
Oh, I have clearly, a letter from the defendant.
Clearly, if there's a letter from the defendant,
okay.
I'm represented by Jim Connors.
Right.
That's sufficient.
Okay. That's what
I thought you were asking me whether the letter alone is sufficient from the lawyer.
I want a letter from the client in the file and sent. That would be enough under your reasoning.
A letter from the client certainly would be enough.
Okay.
Mr. Lebarski, what if you had the situation where you had a letter from the lawyer and you also had a signature at the bottom from Daniel? Is that sufficient?
Well, the state suggested in its brief that would probably be sufficient. I think the state suggests that had there been a faxed copy signed by Dagnall, or had Dagnall co-signed the letter, that would be sufficient. And that may be a point you could clarify with the state. But certainly in my opinion, that would be sufficient. I think that there's another...
Do you have any authority for that other than Jackson?
Pardon me?
Do you have any authority for that position other than Jackson?
No.
What about Patterson?
Well, Patterson essentially followed Jackson and said that the right doesn't flow automatically from the charge itself. It's something that has to be asserted. So I don't think that Patterson distinguishes Jackson at all. I guess as I'm running out of time here, that there's a couple of points that I'd like to make. And one is a practical point, and that is what more could the lawyer have done in this situation? If you are a private practitioner contacted by family or the defendant himself to represent someone, you write a letter saying, I represent so-and-so. I understand this is the situation. Please don't talk to him. If you're Dagnall, what more can you do than assert what your lawyer told you?
He can keep quiet.
He could. He could have kept quiet and said absolutely nothing, or theoretically he could have said, I'm not talking to you. But I just don't think that the Sixth Amendment ought to hinge on how artful or inartful the defendant says things. You know, we ought not, I guess in my opinion, kind of trip over ourselves to minimize or to diminish this particular right. The cases suggest we ought to take a broad rather than narrow interpretation to this right, and certainly the right is fundamental enough that it ought to be safeguarded carefully.
Do you have anything more to say on whether Mr. Connors actually spoke to the defendant? Is that in the record at all?
There's nothing more in the record apart from the letter and the statements. And the defendant's statement in particular, my lawyer said I shouldn't talk to you, certainly gives rise to the inference of a conversation between the two of them, insofar as the defendant is repeating what his lawyer told him to say at some point.
Does it matter whether the lawyer he was referring to was Connors? What difference does it make?
I don't think it does.
Doesn't matter. Even if he's lying and he had no lawyer.
Correct. I mean, it's his right to assert, and whether you know he's got a particular lawyer in mind or a different lawyer, I don't think it probably makes a lot of difference. I'd like to go back to a point that Justice Babbage discussed with regard to whether or not this is really clarification in terms of what the police did. If you find that the letter is ambiguous and the statements are ambiguous and that we ought to adopt a new rule requiring clarification, I have a difficult time accepting the fact that the detective statements in this case amounted to clarification. The purpose of clarification is to discern and not to persuade. And certainly the statements of the police in this case suggesting that they had been gathering other information, talking to other people, an interest in the defendant's side of the story, suggests to me not simply an attempt to discern the defendant's desire with regard to counsel, but an attempt to persuade them to give a statement.
But what about Justice Sykes' point that the Mirandization, is very antiseptic. Is antiseptic. Or at least arguably antiseptic.
It's arguably antiseptic, but certainly an easier thing to say to him was, after he said, my lawyer said I shouldn't talk to you, would have been, do you have a lawyer? End of the inquiry. I don't know that Miranda would have been required as a means of clarification. Tacking Miranda on to the end of a discourse concerning the current efforts of investigation, I don't think saves the day as far as clarification is concerned. If there are no other questions, I would thank you for your careful attention to this case.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Freiman.
Could I ask you, right off the bat, Mr. Lubarsky asked the question, what more could the lawyer have done? What is your answer to that?
The lawyer could have had the defendant, sign the letter, get a fax signature of some kind. He could have expressed in the letter that the defendant has personally retained and accepted me as his counsel in this case. I think if he had done that in the attorney letter, then when the officers come to Florida to get him, they're certainly on notice that they better find out, is this true that you have an attorney in this case? Short of that, I don't think they did have the obligation to come down and say, you know, is this letter from Attorney Connors true that he represents you? I don't think that is a constitutional requirement unless they have some reason to believe that he, in fact, has personally accepted an attorney in this case. I think there's the critical difference, as I see it, between the two positions here is the difference between being aware of having a lawyer and accepting a lawyer for that case and then expressing that acceptance to the police. The difference in the my lawyer comment here under these facts is that my lawyer comment could mean I'm aware that somebody's hired a lawyer for me, but I'm not sure I'm accepting a lawyer in this case. It could mean what the defendant says also, that my lawyer means I have accepted a lawyer in this case. And that's where, by clarifying, by saying, well, it's your decision, these are your rights under the Fifth Amendment and Sixth Amendment, Miranda applies, the Miranda warnings apply to both. that by giving those, the officers, in effect, clarified what the defendant wanted to do. And the language that the defendant uses is critical, I think, here. And I don't mean to you know, get semantics to be the end-all here, but because of the way he phrased it, a reasonable officer could say, what does the defendant want to do here? I know what some attorney is saying, that maybe I've got, you know, that I'm representing him. But we have to hear, and the defense, I don't think, disputes this, that the defendant has to personally invoke it. So that gets to the my lawyer thing. And if that isn't an unambiguous invocation, they don't have to, they have to clarify, because we're talking now about Sixth Amendment, the right the counsel has attached.
Immediately clarify.
Immediately within the same response to that statement. And I think that's what was accomplished here. In Patterson, I would stress that the U.S. Supreme Court points out that the need for an attorney for purposes of responding to custodial interrogation is really no different just because there's been a complaint filed. I mean, the defendant's in the same position here, whether it's before or after charging. It's up to him to decide how he wants to proceed. And where you've got a situation like this, where a reasonable officer could say, you know, I don't know what this defendant really wants to do here with respect to an attorney, giving him his Miranda rights. And I think part of it was an adequate response. And I think part of the problem here is, you know, nobody, we're looking at this on a paper record. The court heard testimony. Nobody's really there to know exactly every single word that's being said. And we don't know when they said, you know, we're here regarding the homicide. I mean, it sounds like the next thing is, well, my lawyer told me not to talk to you. Had they immediately gone down there and said, you know, these are your Miranda rights, you might have gotten a different response here. But when he volunteered this, my lawyer, it really didn't clear anything up. And so they're still back in the position of, well, we'll give you your Miranda rights, and that'll clarify what you want to do.
As a practical matter, does this ever happen when you've got the lawyer and the client in the same city?
It could happen, I suppose. I think this is unique in the sense that here's a defendant out of state, and the timing of this, it's not even clear from Attorney Connor's letter whether he knows there's been a formal charging document, I don't think. It sounds like he's aware he's arrested, and I suppose you could infer that that means there's an arrest warrant. But if you're in the same city, you're more apt to get, you know, if an attorney is really thinking about this, he should get from the defendant what the defendant wants to do. There's no reason police can't question a defendant just because the Sixth Amendment right has attached. It has to be personally expressed. And the attorney should know that, and the attorney should ensure that the defendant understands that he's got to personally express that. Here, this letter just doesn't say what the defendant wants to do, whether he's accepted an attorney or not. And his my lawyer comment, which is the crux of this case, I believe, is ambiguous and was clarified to the contrary. I think you look after the fact of what happened here. The defendant tells the officer, well, I'm sure glad that, I know this attorney told me not to talk to you, but I'm sure glad I did. I mean, I think this is, and this sort of supports the inference that what was going on with that initial statement was that the officer was understanding the defendant of having some uncertainty what he wanted to do.
Counsel, in your brief at page 5, when you give the statement of facts, you say that at the bottom of page 5, Detective Hughes said that in contacting defendant in Florida, he hoped defendant would provide a statement about the homicide. He said his intent was, quote, to educate defendant, end quote, as to what officers had been told or had learned about the crime, so defendant, quote, could make a decision as to whether he wanted to talk to us or not. Is it your position that after the defendant made the statement that his attorney wouldn't want him to talk about it, that the thing that was next said by the officers was to educate the defendant as to what officers had been told? Is that the next thing to come down, so to speak?
It sounds like it from the police report. Again, I think this is part of one response, and that is it says, you know, we want to tell you that we've got information about this. We'd like to hear your side. It's your decision how you want to proceed. These are your Miranda rights. I think that's part of the response. Just to take it a step further, I think the subjective intent of the officers obviously is not what's controlling here. I mean, clearly they would want to hear from the defendant if he wants to talk to them. But it's the objective test as to what happened here and whether or not they could reasonably conclude that this was an ambiguous assertion of counsel, that what they did in response was reasonably to clarify that what the defendant wanted to do, not what some attorney told him would be a good idea, and properly did that, and then the waiver follows after that. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Framus. The court is in a recess until 1:45, and the students here, as well as anyone else who wishes